Good morning, Your Honor. May it please the court, my name is Jean Jorgensen, and I'm here today representing the appellants Don and Karen Berg, and Mr. Berg is here with me today. I'd like to reserve 4 minutes for rebuttal, please.
Proceed.
There are two major decisions on appeal in this particular case. The first involves the hearing examiner's decision in a land use matter. The second one involves the Superior Court decision to deny a CR 60 motion for relief from the hearing examiner's decision based upon misconduct of the City of Kent. Turning first to the LUPA appeal, the first error involves the rendering of a decision that lacks the specificity for permitting appellate review. Namely, the decision fails to provide any meaningful factual or legal determination. Now, of course, the issue before the hearing examiner was whether or not an outdoor storage business existed within Shady Park prior to the NCC zoning ordinance that was passed by the City of Kent in 1998. And if so, whether or not there was an illegal expansion of that outdoor storage, which was conceded to be a legal nonconforming use by the City of Kent. Yet in his decision, the hearing examiner failed to mention anything about that in his findings of fact. He didn't mention anything about illegal nonconforming use. He didn't mention anything about how this outdoor storage was expanded after 1998.
But he did reference the notice of violation, the fairly lengthy notice of violation.
He did reference a notice of violation, which incorporated a notice of correction. But he only referenced it in terms of giving a sort of procedural history of what was going on. He didn't say, I'm basing my decision on all the facts there. He did list that it existed, but he didn't say that his decision was based on that. And I think that's significant. And
what other evidence was there to base a decision on?
Well, all the evidence that the Burks presented, actually.
But he didn't find their witnesses credible.
He said he didn't find them could be credible in a conclusory statement. He didn't say who was not credible or why they were not credible. And in order to have the appellate court take a look and see, you know, was there evidence at all that any of the witnesses were not credible, we have to have more than that. We have to have, you know, some ability to determine whether or not there was substantial evidence in order to determine an adverse finding of credibility. So the notice of correction and notice of violation were, you know, allegedly incorporated, as the city argues, but that would be improper under the Weyerhaeuser case that we've cited. You can't just incorporate one side's evidence as your own and not actually deal with the factual issues that are in dispute. That is error to do that. And the LaBelle case also supports that contention that you can't just incorporate somebody's, you know, summary of the evidence that was before the hearing even occurred. So none of the Bergs' witnesses, none of the Bergs' evidence was at all put into account. Their theories were not put into account. This is basically the hearing examiner filling out, you know, some kind of a pre-standard form that lists all the evidence and lists the witnesses and then makes
But he found the witnesses not credible, and that's clear in his order, isn't it?
He does say that the witnesses were not credible.
And we can't judge their credibility.
No, you can't judge their credibility, but you can determine whether or not there's substantial evidence on the record to justify an adverse credibility determination, and that is, in fact, your role as the appellate court. And so,
what does that mean, to justify an adverse credibility determination?
So,
when I did traffic ticket cases, I would look down at Free Americans and I would say, I don't believe you. They were usually shocked to hear it, but it was the clearest record I could make of why I was ruling against them. Okay? That was subject to review on appeal, whether there was substantial evidence, the record, for my conclusion that I did not believe them?
What are you arguing that we do? What I'm saying is that, you know, especially when we're talking about a variety of people, we're not talking about just one witness in this case. We're talking about several witnesses. I mean, you can make a determination of credibility based on several things. One can be just the way that you're perceiving somebody's behavior. You know, if they're red in the face, if they're sweating, if they, you know, are looking around or looking down, avoiding eye contact. Well, there's all kinds of things like that you can look at and that you could, you know, make a part
of
that.
Did I have to say that? Did I have to say that to these drivers? I don't believe you. That's not shocking enough. I don't like the way you look.
Well,
you're kind of sweaty. You get red in the face. I mean, what did I have to say to convey the basis for my decision beyond, I don't believe you?
Mm-hmm. I think that you need to do a little bit more, and that is to say by, you know, just the demeanor during the testimony. I don't think that you have to be rude about it, but I do think you have to mention that if that's what the case is, the demeanor. It can also be the inconsistency, the testimony that is being given that is inconsistent with either the prior testimony that the witness has been given, or maybe it's inconsistent with the documents in the record, something like that. But, you know, just having nothing on the record at all about why someone's not credible certainly leaves us in a position where we can't understand why that would be. How can, you know, six different people or more, you know, be determined by the hearing examiner as not credible in any way? None of their testimony was credible. Maybe part of it was. Maybe part of it wasn't. We don't know at this point because there's absolutely no findings of fact in the decision that lead us to that. Additionally, the hearing examiner also shifted the burden of proof to the Bergs as set forth in finding of fact number 8. And this is an error of law because, of course, the Bergs never had any burden. The city went first because they had the burden of proof. Their code says they have the burden of proof. And so, and they've conceded numerous times before, during, and after the hearing that the outdoor storage enjoyed the status of a legal nonconforming use. And so the Bergs didn't have to prove that because the city had conceded that many, many times in the record. And now, for the very first time on appeal, the city is saying, oh, no, they had the burden of proving a legal nonconforming use with respect to the King County Code, which had, you know, existed back in 1958. That was never an issue before the hearing examiner, as you can plainly see, just from the city attorney's representations and opening statement, as well as her statements to the hearing examiner when I made a motion for directed verdict. And then, additionally, the city...
So you're aware that you're running through your rebuttal time at the moment.
Oh, thank you very much. I appreciate you telling me that. I wasn't aware of that. So the city also, you need to look at the Kent City Code, which does not allow the city to determine what the scope of outdoor storage would be permissible, because the express language of that code says use is defined as land that is intended for which it is maintained. And it's only the landowner that can actually determine what is intended. And, of course, from all the testimony and the evidence in the case, the entire lot was surrounded by a fence for the purpose of outdoor storage. Now, I'll turn briefly to the CR 60 motion, in which we've asked for relief upon several grounds. But the main one that needs to be looked at is misconduct of an adverse party. In this case, the city offered false testimony collaboratively about prior code violations and why they had all been resolved. All the code violations dealt with the resolution of the outdoor storage as a legal nonconforming use, and Brian Swanberg was located later, confirmed that the city actually had taken an adverse possession position during this hearing examiner proceeding. And so that was why we contend that the city obstructed their ability to subpoena Mr. Swanberg.
But in terms of the Swanberg, having the Swanberg declaration in the record, that's we're looking at it for abuse of discretion, right?
By the trial. Yes, you are, indeed. Yes. Thank you
all
very much.
You'll have 2 minutes on rebuttal then. Thank you.
Good morning, Your Honors. May it please the Court, my name is Stephanie Kroll, and I'm here representing the City of Kent. Also present is the city attorney, Mr. Tom Brubaker, to observe proceedings and be able to report back to the city on what happened here today. First of all, the only real issue before the court, the only proper issue before the court, is whether there has been substantial evidence in the record to support the hearing examiner's final decision that the Bergs unlawfully expanded a nonconforming use on their property. And the nonconforming use was a commercial outdoor storage yard. And
what about the state of the findings of fact and the conclusions? I mean, typically we look at the evidence to see if they support the findings of fact, the findings of fact to see if they support the conclusions. But these are pretty brief.
The hearing examiner did prepare findings of fact and a conclusion of law, and in those findings of fact, he incorporated the notice of violation, which had incorporated a previous document also. And those are in the clerk's records, pages 1 through 55. Every single statement of fact and every single violation of the city code is specified in pages 1 through 55, along with supporting documents.
He doesn't incorporate. He doesn't state that he's incorporating that by reference.
Well, I beg to differ on that because he doesn't use the term incorporated by reference herein. What he does is that he doesn't just mention them in the findings, as has been stated by the Bergs. That is a misstatement, and it is intended to draw the court's attention away from the actual findings and conclusions. And if you look at conclusion number one, the hearing examiner says, based on the findings, and this is in quotes, the Bergs violated the Kent City Code as set out in the notice of violation. And by saying that they
does that
violated
mean on the legal basis as set forth in the notice of violation?
They violated the, based on the findings, they violated the city code as set out in the notice of violation.
I'm asking, does that mean, it, when he says as set out, does he talk about that's the legal basis for it?
I believe that's the factual and the legal.
Well, this is,
because he said based on the findings.
This is where this gets kind of tricky, because the notice of violation was written before the hearings took place.
Correct.
So it can't really be his findings after the hearing if it's something that's written before the hearing took place, can it?
Well,
if it's about facts?
If you look at the notice of violation, you will see that the city put in chronological order, painstakingly, the facts upon which the notice of violation was issued.
Yeah, I
at the hearing.
But I'm looking, and when I see the notice of violation in terms of giving notice of what the claim violation is, notice, in terms of setting forth what the legal issues are, real good utility for that, to incorporate that. But you're talking about somebody after a proceeding incorporating a document that was written before the proceeding, before any of the evidence came in, and that's the substitute?
Well, the evidence came in, and all of the city's witnesses testified with regard to each of the statements that are in the notice of violation.
Did they actually do that? Did they sit up there with the notice of violation and read from it?
They didn't read from it. They went through it on basis by basis. And I can, if the court.
And I know it took 8 separate days, so maybe this is why.
Yeah, it was long. It was arduous. There was a intense cross-examination
like
of the witnesses.
Quicker. If all you were doing was asking people to read from a document that had been written before the hearing, boy, that shouldn't go all that long.
They had intense cross-examination on each issue, and based upon those 8 days of hearings, the hearing examiner decided, maybe you wouldn't do it this way, and maybe I wouldn't do it this way, but the hearing examiner decided that the city had proved every fact that was stated in the notice of violation.
But I'm troubled with one fact in particular. The city based a large portion on 2 aerial photographs, a 1996 aerial photograph and then subsequent aerial photograph.
Correct.
But if you read the hearing examiner during the proceedings, he didn't like that. He was very upset about that, sent the city back saying he wanted more evidence. But yet we get nothing.
Okay, I'm not exactly positive which portion of the record you're talking about, but the hearing examiner questioned witnesses for the city and questioned witnesses for the Bergs extensively. And he was frustrated numerous times because the Bergs were pro se and they weren't following the rules and they were making assumptions about documents and evidence that weren't correct, and the hearing examiner would stop and interject and say, this is what this means. This is what you have to prove to me. You can't make conclusory statements. You need more.
Didn't he also raise concern of you offering 2 snapshot aerial photographs that you really didn't know what was going on in between those times? Wasn't he frustrated with
he
that?
He said,
all?
I believe that he conceded, I don't know that he was frustrated, but I believe that he conceded that A single photograph at a single time shows what the property is like at that date, but it doesn't show what it's like the next day, and it doesn't show what it's like the day before. But when you have a sequence of aerial photos, as the city presented, along with testimony from both the Bergs and the city of Kent as to the gradual development of this property
was two,
and the expansion.
Was two the sequence?
Pardon?
You
no,
talked
there
about
were,
a sequence of aerial photos. How many aerial photos were there?
There were the two aerial photos that showed what portion of the prop. Those two aerial photos showed what portion of the property could legally be used as an outdoor storage attendant to the auto shop.
What else was in the sequence you referred to? Is that a sequence of?
There are, Your Honor. And I'm going to. There's a photo from, okay, so we have the photos from 1996 and 1999. And we have photos from, I believe it's 2000. I believe this one is from 2006. We get 2007. Showing additional. I could be wrong on those dates.
So are the latter ones
but there,
to show
there's
what,
definitely. Then, they, then
are
we
the
have
the latter ones to show what you believe are violations.
Yes.
And the first ones were to show what you think was the existing use.
Yes, Your Honor. Yes, Your Honor. And there also are photos of the property from the 1930s, 1940s, and 1950s. And I've given in my briefing the citations to the record where those occur, and they show a fully wooded lot with a grocery store and a gas station that subsequently did go out of business, but it was replaced with the auto shop. And so we have a grocery store and an auto shop, and photos from earlier show the lot full of trees. The aerial photos starting with 1996 show the lot empty, full of trees and shrubs, with just a discrete portion of property being used. And based on the additional testimony and evidence provided by the parties, the court felt that the city's findings of fact were accurate. And you also have to have substantial evidence. That's the standard here. And the standard for substantial evidence is there substantial evidence in the record as a whole to support the decision of the hearing examiner?
But
so,
isn't it problematic if what your aerial photographs show is a tree canopy, that they don't show what's going on under the tree canopy?
And that is a little bit not accurate description of the aerial photograph, because you can see over by the shrubs, for example, where there's no tree canopy, there's no development, there's nobody parking cars, there's no one parking bridges, and also under the tree canopy you can see some of the vehicles that are under the tree canopy, and they are apparent. And had there been additional vehicles underneath the trees, they would have also been apparent as big shiny objects moving the trees and bushes aside. We don't dispute that perhaps the testimony from the Bergs is correct in that intermittently they might have allowed a resident to park a mobile home or a boat on their property. But that does not establish a non-conforming use for an outdoor storage yard. One
thank
use
you,
at Coach. One time. Yeah. Thank you, Your Honors. And thank you for allowing me to complete my argument.
And again, the use of a storage yard has to be looked at very uniquely in that
A storage yard is not a legal use under this zoning, correct?
It is not under the NCC outdoor storage, correct?
And it wasn't prior to 1996 either. It was also residential at that time.
Well, 1996, the city of Kent had not passed NCC zoning. So I would argue that it was a legal nonconforming use, but it was not in compliance with the zoning at that time.
So in 1996, the city declared that we're going to leave the auto repair and the parking around the auto repair. We're just going to call that a legal nonconforming use. Is that right?
Our position is that, yes, they said the commercial operations on the property were legal nonconforming uses.
And currently, the use are, at the time of the violation, the entire parcel was being used for parking and storage, and you'd removed much of the tree cover, correct?
So it depends on what you mean by the time of violation. So this was a violation that was determined in about 2011, arbitrarily by the city, saying you could only have this much property, and that the two photographs that they were using are the ones that are relevant and were being asked about, was the 1996 photograph and the 1999, and they just arbitrarily drew this orange line around that property saying this is what you can use, and it had grown beyond that. But intensification, of course, is permissible. And
is it your position that Kent gave the property owners more rights than they had prior to annexation?
No, not at all.
With regard to the use?
Not at all. The whole entire property was surrounded by a fence. It was a legal nonconforming use, and it was devoted
well,
and
no,
intended
I'm not,
use.
I don't want to, I mean, so we know that there was, that the whole nonconforming use started in 1958.
Correct. Before okay. then, but yes.
And so, okay, well, time's up.
Okay. Thank you so much, Your Honor.
That concludes our calendar this morning. Court will be in recess.
I know. They were mad at me, and I was trying to.